Welcome back to TRP.
Hi, welcome back to the Ross Lair podcast. Today we listen in to Claire Daly and Mick Wallace as they discuss the trial of Algirdas Paleckis, former journalist and MP from Lithuania. They also discuss COP26 in Glasgow and the depressing reluctance of some rich countries to take meaningful action on climate change.
Lithuania, we're only back this morning, so a bit on the rough side, but what's your first impressions? Well, I know it's not your first time to Lithuania, but kind of...
We had about 10 and a half hours of it in total yesterday, in one form or another. It was pretty shocking. Obviously, we were going to the trial of Algirdas, and what's he been accused of? He's been accused of espionage. In other words, they're accusing him of spying on behalf of the Russians. And of course, it kind of started over the fact that Algirdas questioned the narrative on an event that happened in January 1991, just before Lithuania got its independence. And it appears that in Lithuania, and seemingly pretty much so in Latvia as well, you're not really allowed to speak your mind. And that really is probably at the root of it. And the manner in which the trial that we witnessed yesterday was held, I tell you what, I won't forget it for a long time.
I think the scary thing about it is that the background to this is kind of a shrinking space for different ideas, which we're beginning to see more and more across the European Union, and this creeping authoritarianism. So basically, without boring people, I mean, in 1991, Lithuania became independent following a sort of a, I suppose, the loosening up of the Soviet times when Gorbachev introduced perestroika and glasnost, which was a kind of a loosening of some of the manner in which the Soviet economy was being run. There were events in Lithuania which, without boring people too much about it, basically the events were the participants in that struggle. There was a protest for independence where 13 people lost their lives. And it, essentially, information has come into the public domain which has said that it was Lithuanian guards who fired on the Lithuanian protesters, whereas the story had been that it was the Russians who had sort of fired on the protesters, and that gave an impetus to the movement for national liberation, for an end to Soviet rule and so on. Now, the truth is that Gorbachev was working with the Lithuanian authorities, I suppose, to give up the Baltics, but certainly the evidence has emerged that it was Lithuanians who shot Lithuanians. And Algirdas simply, I suppose, repeated that point, and it's been done on the basis of sort of, because he's not reflecting the official narrative, really. And I suppose he's questioned some of the rulings of Lithuanian judges who have passed verdicts on these matters, like, you know. So it all sounds a bit like sort of John le Carré sort of mad stuff. But essentially, he's in court for having expressed a political view. And he's already, let's remember, he has spent 18 months in solitary confinement for this already. This has gone on since 2018. He paid big money to get out on bail eventually, and he's been under house arrest since. He wears a bracelet. And the case was essentially an appeal to try and stop him going back to prison again. But he had quite a good crowd of supporters there in that as well, you know.
So, if I'm correct, Algirdas Paleckis is a former journalist and an MP and also a leader of a left-wing party. The whole case has been criticised as not having enough evidence. Did you see anything about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, well, first of all, Algirdas said that Lithuanians shot Lithuanians, and it wasn't Gorbachev's, the security forces that killed the Lithuanians that day in January 1991. And he literally said in an interview on a radio station that Lithuanians shot Lithuanians in January 91 and that it wasn't the Russians. And he's, I mean, the notion that he's already spent 18 months in solitary confinement for saying that. And on top of that, he's been wearing, since he got his, he got, so I've obviously got help for a bail of $50,000 to get out of prison. Euros, was it? To get out of prison. And to put a shackle on him, right? So that he could be tracked everywhere, right? And it's cutting his leg as well, and it's having an impact on him. And actually, that issue came up in the court yesterday as well, because he asked for the judge's permission if she would instruct that it be removed, that he isn't going to go anywhere, given that there's a bail of 50,000 on him, and that he's as eager as anyone else to see the end of the trial, and he isn't going to be going running out of the country. She actually said, "Oh, we'll make a decision on that next Monday, the 22nd of November." But there was things happened in the court yesterday on the day that would make the hair stand on your head.
Yeah, I mean, I think the point is, and as you said, Bethany, what is the evidence against him? And this is one of the most striking things, because there actually is no clear evidence against him. And the whole debate in the court was that a lot of this information was protected by the Lithuanian secret services. So they basically had a fella in court, and they literally came in, three big hefty yokes in khaki gear and balaclavas, march into the court when the judges came in, and this was a so-called protected witness. Now, everybody knows who this guy is. He is a convicted paedophile who got out of prison early on the basis of giving evidence to say that, oh yeah, Algirdas told him he was involved in kind of giving state secrets to the Russians. And this fella said he was a spy as well. Now, they haven't actually said what information it was that they passed on. The tapes of their supposed conversations, the Secret Service have said, they're not even giving them to the judges. So not only could the court not see the charges, or Algirdas' defence team, nobody could see the charges other than a small piece where they maybe released a recording where they used maybe, you know, two lines out of a 40-minute conversation that was recorded. The rest is official. And what a lot of the court dealt with, could that be admitted? Could the court get access to that information? And basically the judges went off and they said, well, look, we'll ask. But probably the Secret Service will say, no, that's a state secret. Now, how in God's name could an EU country that claims to be democratic, that somebody is not entitled to due process, you're not entitled to know the charges against you or answer them. You couldn't defend yourself against that.
And there's zero evidence being presented. They're literally hiding behind the Secret Services, saying, oh, we know the stuff against them, but we can't tell you because it's top secret. I mean, you couldn't make it up. And I mean, one of the points that we made after the court case yesterday was that Europe, the European Union, talks night and day about rule of law. Now, listen, I've been in an awful lot of court cases in Ireland, and I wouldn't for a second try and boast that everything is done great in the legal system in Ireland. But I can tell you something now, it's quite a damn sight better than what goes on in Lithuania. And if Ireland and Lithuania are supposed to be working under the same rule of law, well, I saw no evidence of it yesterday, because what happened, what we saw yesterday, would not happen in a court case in Ireland. And you wouldn't see fellas coming in with balaclavas on them, hiding their identity. In a court case, no judge in Ireland but up with it.
I mean, you want to see, like, they were literally sitting on the bench beside us, three big yokes sitting in their balaclavas, like, sort of muscled up. It was just unreal. And your man, the fella who was the so-called witness who had given, he asked to be excused from the court because he didn't want to be there. And the judges said, he said, look, I'm kind of, I told you before what I had to say. I don't really want to be sitting here in this appeal, and can I just have my lawyer here? And the judge said, oh yeah, okay. And your man just gets up and leaves. He walked out in the middle of the court with his two heavies with him. And then there's Algirdas presenting medical evidence about the tag that he's wearing now and how it's interfering with his sleep and everything, and they need a week to think about that. And the case has been adjourned now until the 12th of January. So for us, this is, you know,
I mean, but this guy, this witness was being dragged in as a witness against Algirdas, right? And he's completely uncomfortable in the place because he's probably lying through his teeth, and he lied in order to get off with his own paedophile offence. But anyway, imagine him letting a paedophile out of prison on the basis, oh, I testified against that fella, so you can let me out now. So a paedophile gets loose.
Well, you can imagine it, because that's exactly what happened in the Assange case as well, where this Icelandic paedophile basically got exonerated of his charges and got released for testifying a total nonsense espionage charge sheet against Julian Assange. So it's interesting that we have Julian Assange in court being extradited for espionage on the lying and admitted liar, because the Icelandic guy said afterwards he completely made it up to get off. And here we have in Lithuania the same thing, a journalist, politician, being prosecuted for espionage, having spent 18 months in solitary confinement, for 6 months, no contact with his family at all. And this is supposedly human rights compliant Lithuania. Unbelievable.
Well, as we know, the rule of law is a huge subject right now in EU affairs. Having looked at the Commission's 2021 report, it's actually said in a positive way, initiatives to strengthen anti-corruption culture in the judiciary are being developed in Lithuania. But as what you've just said, it doesn't seem to be the case. What do you think? How do you think this is reflective on the Commission's general kind of...
Well, I suppose it reinforces our argument with the pamphlet that we produced, that the Commission is completely partisan in its application of rule of law. It's not about rule of law. It's about who you are. And basically, Lithuania, it can do what it likes because it's on Russia's border. And as long as they continue to be totally Russia-phobic, which they are, probably the biggest proponents of it in the EU, then that's good enough for the Commission, that they have their NATO bases, they have the border toughened. Of course, they're now busy keeping refugees out in that as well. So they're a bit busy in that. They don't seem to care about them, but they brought in appalling laws which violate human rights of refugees as well in response to the Belarusian crisis. But
And we've heard MEPs from Lithuania being really, really seriously concerned about human rights in Belarus, but they don't seem to be too interested in human rights issues in Vilnius, their own
in their own, against their own journalists and politicians, or against their own international obligations in terms of asylum law and that. And I suppose one of the striking things, and we were making the point to people, because we met some really lovely activists and people from Lithuania and from Latvia, is that the countries, again, this is a feature of the European Union, have been gutted out. Like, Lithuania had a population nominally of over 4 million, but about 1.5 million of them aren't there. And we were kind of remarking that we'd never been in a place as quiet. Like, Vilnius has about, well, two different people told us. One person told us that 600,000, another said 800,000, but it was the quietest place we ever were. Like, there was literally nobody around. Sure there wasn't.
Well, on the Monday night, there was very few around. A little bit more on Tuesday, on the day of the court case, but... it was striking, and we actually checked the figures and discovered that Lithuanians are the third largest influx of foreigners into Ireland. So there's an awful lot of Lithuanians in Ireland.
We hadn't realised. It was actually seemingly Ireland and Britain initially let the Lithuanians and the Latvians in when other European countries didn't.
That's
I never
right.
understood why there were so many.
Continental Europe was... We were even after Lithuania joining the EU, mainland Europe said, no, not yet. And Ireland and England and Britain let them in before the rest of Europe. And that's why the most Lithuanians are actually
huge
in Ireland.
Huge community there
and
now,
Britain today.
Yeah. Which is why it's important for us. And actually, we had some Irish students in Vilnius in contact with us as well, Lithuanian Irish who are studying there now. So it's an important community in Ireland. And that's why we, I suppose, also think it's important for us to go to that case and to bear testimony again about what is going on here, because the narrative of a democratic EU is just absolute nonsense. And of course, by us being there, it did put the pressure on. Like, let's just say they knew we were there and we got to meet good activists and that. So it was well worthwhile, and we need to monitor that now for the hearing again in January.
And another important event that happened just this week, the COP26 agreement finalised this weekend. What are your general opinions on the Glasgow Climate Pact?
Well, it's actually been going on for the last 2 weeks. And Damien, obviously,
our
climate, our environmental expert, was there for the 2 weeks. I haven't really been talking to him much about it yet. But I suppose... generally speaking, a huge disappointment. Some have described it as a betrayal of the people, a betrayal of science, and the only people who will be celebrating it are big business and the fossil fuel industry. And really, what happened in Glasgow was that the richest countries, like the European Union and the US and the UK, they blocked all progress. They didn't do their fair share and keeping limits on targets to limit temperatures to below 1.5 just didn't happen. They didn't progress that. The still unmet promise of 100 billion either. And so, which is really only a drop in the ocean in terms of if we're really going to compensate the developing world and help them to actually deal with the problems of climate change.
It's utterly depressing, really. I mean, it's yet another example of where, I suppose, the reality is one thing, and the manner in which it's presented is an entirely another, you know. So we had this big jamboree around it. The media were all over it, like RTE, everywhere. And it was the same internationally. Every media outlet was there, and you'd have, OK, now we're going to go and meet Micheál Martin. Now, Micheál, what's Ireland going to do? And all you get back is waffle, total waffle, that belies the measures that are actually necessary. But the media don't present, they just present it as, oh, well, this was agreed, that was agreed. And because the figures are there, most people go, switch off, gone. I'm not even listening. It's background noise because people can't. It's the best way. Every politician knows this. That's what they do. Like, you know, you ask them a question and they come back with a load of figures and immediately the person switches off and you lose them. And that's probably what's been happening. There's nothing concrete done. Even the Paris Agreement targets are actually not going to be met by this. The planet is in serious trouble, and yet the media kind of go, oh, well, let's move on to what happened next in something on telly, like, or whatever.
I mean, but the scientists have been saying for a long time now that unless loss and damage is dealt with, unless the developing world, the global south, are compensated and help them to move away from the use of fossil fuels themselves, they have to develop as well. I mean, the vast majority of the damage has already been done by the developed world. But they don't want to know about it. They don't want to take the historic responsibility. But we are not going to solve the crisis of climate change until the rich countries take responsibility for all the damage they've done. And that's the simple fact of it.
On this, the EU themselves are refusing to establish a separate financing for loss and damages. What do you think the EU should be doing in this regard?
Well, I mean, I think that the EU, I mean, the biggest culprit in Glasgow opposing progress on loss and damage were the Americans, because they're actually they're probably the biggest culprits of them all. But unfortunately, Europe backed the Americans on it, as did the UK. And that was sold as trying for most countries in the world, where most of the people live, where most of the damage has been done, because the global south is in on the receiving end of most of the direct impact of climate change. They're getting more floods, they're getting more droughts. I mean, there's millions of lives at risk all the time in the global south. It's not having quite as much of an impact on countries in the developed world as of yet. But I mean, like, for example, there was floods in Germany there last summer?
And yeah. Here, yeah.
Right, okay, well, I mean, the German government allocated 30 billion to respond to those floods. But there was floods in Uganda, and the Ugandan government was unable to respond. It's already paying out huge amount of money in debt repayments. It's locked into inequality, and countries like Uganda are completely overwhelmed with inequality, with unfair treatment by the developed world, with the responsibility now of trying to actually deal with the sort of the floods and droughts that are coming their way. And yet we have the developed world with all the money refusing to put their hand in their pocket and actually go to the space and make the progress on loss and damage. It's really terrible.
It's mad. It is kind of how the media presented, and that is just so...
Yeah, and I mean...
out of kilter. It's like a big show, like the way, oh, who's here? Let's go and meet this little indigenous group from this part of the global south and we'll hear about their little problems. But it's done in a kind of a way that it's almost a pantomime or a play, that it's not actually real lives. It's really frightening stuff.
Well, talking about news coverage, a lot of it focused on the last-minute decision of India and China to water down the draft of the Climate Pact to phase out unabated coal and power and inefficient fossil fuels. Do you think that this is right that a lot of the tension is focused just on this aspect?
Well, actually, fact, there was a real slay of hand on that, right? And it was pointed out afterwards that there would be agreed texts would have amendments and they'd be put into them in advance of them being presented on the floor. Like, for example, if the US had been putting in amendments or the Europeans into text, it'd be done in advance. But the English obviously chaired the COP. It was their gig, right? And but they insisted, the English insisted that India make the amendment on the floor so that it would be blamed, right? And that then because, of course, the media then would take away the headline idea that India was blocking something on fossil fuels. But the reality is that the rich developed countries, for them, you see, coal is an aging infrastructure, right? And most of them are already transiting away from it. Like, for example, I mean, Margaret Thatcher was taking England away from coal years and years ago, and she couldn't spell environment. It had nothing even to do with the environment. Mm-hmm. It was just something that was happening, and oil and gas became much more attractive for the developed countries. So they've been moving away from coal anyway, right? Whereas countries like India, South Africa, and even China still are completely dependent on it, right? But there's been... But really what the Indians are saying is, ye use fossil fuels to develop and get where yous are today. Are you telling us that we can't use them so that we can develop out of the poverty that we're in, and that we can get there? And that's they're saying that with one side. Mm-hmm. And then they're saying on the other, well, you know what now? If you want us to stop using coal, well, help us to stop using it. Mm-hmm. Give us the finance to move away from it. And the developed world is saying, no, we're not partnering our money. We're not going to that space.
Which was their money anyway, because most of the money in the West originated in those countries in the first place and was robbed out of them with the colonialism.
And what the science has been saying is that not only coal, but oil and gas as well, that we've got to move away from them all. But the rich countries don't want to talk yet about getting rid of oil and gas, because they're actually up to their knees in it still. And they want to keep using them for as long as it suits them.
Mm. And we've seen that here, like with already a whole number of even EU countries trying to water down commitments given on a European basis, like, and delay some of the measures that Europe talks about implementing in terms of renewable energy and so on. All saying, oh, no, it's too quick. We can't move to that yet. But then they blame the Global South for something similar. Madness. Yeah.
Yeah, and listen, and you know what? I mean, what was really shocking as well, I mean, obviously, the Americans, right? I mean, if you're wondering about the two-faced nature of the Western countries, right, when it comes to these climate negotiations, I mean, they're focusing on coal because we've largely moved away from it, but they don't want to talk about the oil and gas because we're still extracting oil and gas and relying on oil and gas. And Biden was in Glasgow and waxing lyrical about, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. But what he forgot to tell them was that the US is about to begin the largest offshore oil and gas lease sale in history. The Department of the Interior in America is going to offer up more than 80 million acres of the Gulf of Mexico for drilling, right? It's the biggest ever fossil fuel project ever, and it's only about to start. I mean, and then they're throwing rocks at India and China. I mean, the hypocrisy.
Well, not only that, but they're presenting it like now that Biden is back in power, the US is back at the environmental table and China isn't here and Russia isn't here. Well, they were, but you know what I mean? They weren't represented by their leaders, but they were making a big play of Biden being there, again, masking the reality of under Biden, the situation is even worse.
This is bigger than any lease sale conducted under Donald Trump's fossil fuel friendly administration. This is bigger than any of them. And it's Biden's. And Biden is saying, Biden has been arguing, oh, I'm kind of locked into it because of things that Trump did. It's actually not true. He can get out of it if he wants to, but he's under too much pressure from the industry. So what we're really saying is the big business in the Western developed world are continuing to say, you know what, lads? We'll sort things, but not yet. Mm.
And there is going to, I mean, that movement that, I mean, we've made the point before that it was like the youth movement that swept Europe and was part of a global movement in any case, really did determine the outcome in many ways of the European elections. Like you had the big groups of Green Party people or Green representatives, people who talked about them getting elected in national governments and to the European Parliament. And it was supposed to herald in a new dawn and everybody wanted to talk about the environment. And like, where is that now? It's there on paper. The deal is rotten. Europe's Green Deal and all this. It's a nonsense.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure people are pretty familiar with Jason Hickel, which we've often mentioned on the podcast, right? But Jason Hickel would be adamant that unblocking the climate negotiations will not happen within our current economic structures and with our political leaders who are prioritising their economic interests in the short term and national economic interests. Mm. And meeting the targets of 1.5 degrees is still a secondary ambition for them, and that's.
Well, I think that's becoming clearer now, and I suppose the task is that movement which maybe unfurled its banners a bit or put them away are going to have to get them out again and get them out a lot more seriously and have not just young people but serious trade unions and industrial might behind a people's battle against those in power, because the way, certainly with those at the helm who are running society for their own private gain, are not going to give up the reins on this, and the planet is in the balance really for it. Like,
and people, there's a figure that people need to keep in mind, and that is that, and it's when we talk about the developed world, it is mostly the North Americas, the US, Canada, and Europe, right? But these figures are stark, but 18% of the world's population have been responsible for 60% of all global emissions, and now they don't want to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Moving on to our next subject, on COVID. Tonight we found out ourselves that Belgium's going to reveal new regulations. There's a lot in the media about this in general in the EU with the increasing cases. What do you think about all this?
Oh, it's so monumentally depressing. Yeah, I mean, Mick's obviously worried now. The old pubs might close a bit earlier here. Personally speaking now, I'm kind of just watching the Christmas market scene. If the Christmas markets are cancelled here, I am going to be severely annoyed, I can tell you. No, look, it's. I think that the world has gone mad in many ways, you know. I suppose the biggest problem I see it is the hysteria now that's been whipped up in Ireland again in the run-up to Christmas, and the impact that that is having on the mental health and well-being of people because of the government's mishandling of it. More and more people are beginning to question what is going on here, because we have the announcement in Ireland yesterday that now the pubs are going to close at 12 and everybody has to go and work at home and all this kind of thing. So you have to go and work at home, but then you can come out at 6 o'clock, get on a bus, go into town, stay in a pub or a restaurant until 12 o'clock. You can go out on a Saturday, sit in a football match with all your friends. Your kids are going to school and coming back, but yet you can't go out to work. I mean, it's just utterly ridiculous, the mixed messaging that they're giving out to people. Like, you know, we have a scenario where 93% of the population is vaccinated, yet they're gone into total panic mode that the system can't deal with the cases that are out there. And nobody is saying, well, why did the system get into that state to begin with? Like, you know, it's the systemic undermining the health service that is behind a lot of this to begin with. But I mean, we've had a lot of people getting in touch about the inconsistencies, I think, in government policy and the lack of answers to questions. And behind all of this, and there was the report done yesterday by the crowd who want to see a fair distribution of vaccines globally. And they were making the point that the big pharma companies are keeping the supply for the booster shots in the Western world because that's where the money is. And Pfizer, BioNTech and Moderna between them had pre-tax profits in the last year of 34 billion euros. Yet the
billion.
Yeah. Yet the MEPs couldn't even see the contracts. They're all redacted in terms of the details. But we know they're costing more and more. And the word is vaccinate, vaccinate, vaccinate. Yet, you know, pretty much everybody in Ireland is vaccinated. And yet, seemingly, COVID is going through the roof. We don't know where it's going to end. There's no consistency. And, yeah.
And we, in the plenary last week, we discussed new legislation that's on the table around COVID and around vaccines. And there's still no access to contracts in planned for the next round. We're still not going to see what's going on with Big Pharma. So you literally have European taxpayers' money being spent by in the billions, and the people are not allowed to see the contracts. Why? Mm. What's going on now?
And then we have a situation like somebody was making the point, like we were in Lithuania, and to go into the supermarket, you have to have a COVID pass to go into the supermarket. Yet when we went into the court, we didn't have to produce anything. We just had to say, no, we'd no COVID symptoms. We didn't have to show anything. So again, contradictory there, you know. And I mean, people have said, well, in an Irish context, if so many people have been vaccinated, 93% of the population now, why are people being asked to show that pass when they go in to a communal setting, given that people, whether they're vaccinated or not, can get COVID and can transmit COVID? So people are asking questions and they're not really getting any answers on it. And the problem is that when they raise questions, if anybody tries to say, hang on a minute, can we actually have a rational conversation about this now, rather than whipping it up hate against people who've been unvaccinated, then you're accused of being an anti-vaxxer. And that's scary to me, is the lack of reasoned debate around this issue is actually frightening, that they're not creating a space. Because at the end of the day, I mean, we're vaccinated, but probably like a lot of people, I mean, I got vaccinated not because I necessarily believe that it's going to protect me, but because I want to travel and I want to go out. And like, that's a bit scary because, you know, one of the fundamental rights is your right to bodily integrity, your right to make fully informed decisions about your medical treatment that you get. But are people really been fully informed? I couldn't say I am. I did it for convenience. But when it's to a situation where the government in Austria says the unvaccinated must be locked in and you can't go to your job. And when we look back at the discussions that were held here around the digital green cert, which we didn't vote for because we felt it was going to undermine fundamental rights, but it was supposed to be, and you can limit fundamental rights if the measures are proportionate, necessary and time limited. Instead of that, they're getting even more extreme. They don't seem to be proportionate at all and they're not time limited. If anything, they're getting time extended.
And if, as it's 91 or 92% of the people in Ireland have got their vaccine, if so many of the people are vaccinated, well, why is there such an obsession about the 8% who are not? Some of them who probably couldn't get it anyway, some of them obviously by choice. But I mean, they're obsessing about the 8% who haven't got it. And, you know, and okay, right, they can argue, well, there's far more of them ending up in ICU beds now than the ones that are vaccinated, and that the vaccination prevents more serious bouts of COVID. But I mean, yet at the same time, there's something seriously discriminatory about their approach. And as Claire was saying earlier, right, I mean, the lack of consistency is eating people up. I heard about three fellas that were run off the a roof. They were putting felt and lats on a roof, right? A new house they were building, right? Three fellas that were at it. And the guards were called to get them off the roof. But 300 or 400 people can go into a meat factory and work indoors. And when I put it to someone, well, why isn't there any consistency about how things have been done? I mean, when is a lockdown a lockdown? Mm. But I mean, if it's not complete lockdown, listen, whether people like it or not, right? And I'm not saying I'd enjoy the infringement on liberty in China, as I wouldn't, because I'd like to be free. But the Chinese did lockdowns and they worked because they were 100% lockdowns and everything was closed until they got on top of it. Mm-hmm. Now, okay, if the Europeans don't want that, well, so be it, right? But I mean, the lockdowns that we've been doing haven't worked. And that's the most consistent factor I've seen since COVID started, is that our lockdowns do not work. They have failed.
Mm. No, and it's also, well, COVID is rampant. And it's spreading everywhere. And the vaccinated and the unvaccinated, and they're all getting it. So, like, it's not working, in a sense. The policies that they brought in are just not working. And, I mean, people are being driven crazy by this. It's, for me, one of the hardest things to take is the lack of rational debate. And that you can't answer the questions that people have. And many people legitimately kind of raise, well, you know, I need better information before I decide to be vaccinated. And that is their right to do that, like, but instead there's kind of a hate speech being whipped up against them, like they can't do anything, their kids can't go on a school tour. They kind of, like, when we brought this in, it was supposed to be, the whole idea of the cert was that the person checking it didn't know what you were, they didn't know if you'd been vaccinated, if you had a negative PCR test, or if you had it before, the thing just went ping, you're okay. Now that's all been translated into a vaccine. You have to have a vaccine. And actually, by focusing on the vaccinated and the unvaccinated, all the other measures like washing your hands, like social distancing, like wearing your mask, the things that actually did work a fair bit in keeping the numbers down when there wasn't vaccinations, are being ignored. So, like, that is completely wrong as well, that you have that scenario that's just a free-for-all in that. So I think there's a lot of things not adding up, and people are getting really stressed, not to mind all the people who can't get other medical treatment because of the hospitals being shut down because of dealing with the surge, so-called, like, you know.
You should read a couple of the points of that email you were reading out this morning. There's some really interesting points in that.
Yeah, I thought it was a really good guy, and I'm sure he won't mind us mentioning the email, but a guy like ourselves who got vaccinated because, you know, he wanted to have a life and all that, and he was just saying, look, I don't know, he said, but I'd really like to see somebody in the media talking about these things. I mean, whoever said asking a question was a crime. One of the points they were making was just about the silence in the media. And he was saying that he found a lot of numbers quite curious, that he did a bit of his own research. And again, I don't know if this is true or not, but it's a very valid basis to discuss it. So he was saying that the average death rate in Ireland has been around 0.63% between 2015 and 2019. That was the average rate. And actually in 2020, the year of COVID, according to the Central Statistics Office, the rate was about the same. Yet all the politicians are saying, oh, there's excess deaths because of COVID. But actually, the figures show there aren't excess deaths because the figures were basically the same. So your man had gone and done research on this. So then he's saying, well, if they're saying, as they have said, that there were 2,237 people who died of COVID last year in Ireland, well, if they died from COVID, you know, and there was zero excess deaths, you know, does that mean that the other thousands of people survived illnesses? It just doesn't really make any sense, you know. He also sort of talked about things whereby the median age of death from COVID was 82. That's as of 2 weeks ago. But actually that the life expectancy in Ireland is 82 as well. Now, he's not saying, oh, so it serves them right, it doesn't matter. But he's just basically saying, well, why all the focus if that is the case? And I thought they were interesting statistics, along with the point that he said that 86% of people who died of COVID had an underlying condition. And that's not in any way to minimise any deaths that take place. But why is the focus and the panic on this if the numbers are not really backing up some of the hysteria that is out there? And again, I'm not in any way taken away from people's own experiences of COVID, but why can't we have a discussion about
exactly
these things?
Yeah, look, I mean, we've argued so much and debated this so much in our own offices, yeah, and we're not able to come up with a consensus, and we don't have all the answers, and we're not sure what is the best way forward. But what we are saying now is that there is a lack of open debate, and if people question the regular narrative and question what the government are doing, they're being written off as crackpots. So the discussion has been closed down. It's a bit like, A bit like some of the anti-Russian and anti-Chinese rhetoric and the failure to actually to rationally debate out these issues, and the attempts by the media at home, for example, would be the RTE or the Irish Times that we were on the receiving end of, where they actually went about actually silencing us. Oh, you can't say this. We'll go after them for saying this. I mean, that's exactly what they were about. And we see the same with COVID, which
but
is
I mean,
really
like
worrying.
People having to produce a pass to go to work in whole numbers of European countries, or people being locked in because they don't have a vaccine pass. I mean, who would have thought that Europe would come to that, like, you know? That is seriously worrying, and there are huge fundamental rights infringements on that. And it's not to say most people are rational and decent people. They don't want to contaminate their neighbours. They don't want to do something that undermines the health of their friends and family. But they are entitled to accurate information. And we do have to remember that behind all of this are big pharmaceutical companies who are making billions, tens of billions, individual companies every year out of this. And the only solution that's been pushed is more vaccine. And the penalty for not getting it is that you could lose your job, like, or your kids can't go on a school tour, or they're totally ostracised, or they can't play football, or this type of nonsense that they were doing before, which again eats away at the mental health. It's not conducive, and we do want to discuss these issues out, and we do want to tease them out. We're not saying one way or another, but we are saying that, my God, people have a right to ask, and the day you stop asking questions is the day in which people should forget about it. Europe had those days in the 1930s. I tell you, it seems like they're coming back, because authoritarianism, be it with COVID, be it with people expressing opinions in Lithuania, be it whatever, ignoring the climate problems, is rampant.
Okay, so I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you all for listening. And hopefully we'll see you next week with Damien. Thank you.
Au revoir.
All the best. Bye-bye.
I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Claire Daly and Mick Wallace for the use of this material. Keep on listening to TRP.